As important a person as there is in my AA program is our speaker tonight. His name is Clint, and it's fun to see him. We don't, as most of you know, we are brothers, and he got into the program some 19 years ago. In fact, I was happened to be down in Southern California, was able to watch him take his 19th take in this program. The difference is rather remarkable now, and how our relationship changes subtly and sometimes not so subtly, but the fellowship of this program has made quite a difference in our relationship. It's fun to see him tonight. We picked up Clint and Gloria at the airport, and it's just great to hoorah around with them, have dinner with them tonight. In any event, we have fun. I'll let him tell you about him. The at dinner tonight, though, just as an example, I'd think that you should know that I can assure you, after having had dinner with him, that I would rather listen to him talk than eat. You know what I mean? Clint, come on up here. Did I say that right? Not so good, huh?
Thank you. My name is Clint. I'm an alcoholic. Well, I've certainly enjoyed the meeting so far. Thanks, Randy, for helping him with the raffle. You should have had those in Braille. It would have gone a little faster. A lot of you thought Randy was wearing an earring, but what they do here at the University of Oregon is they catch a guy sleeping in the park, they tag his ear and make him go to AA meetings. It's science. That's all it is. It's science. I'm glad Carl and Liz have been having fun together. They did pick us up at the airport, took time out of their busy day to do it, and I think that, and it's always fun to be with them, and I certainly enjoyed getting to know Liz. You know, Carl and Liz have been going together for a little while now. Just before they started going together, Liz, her uncle died, and left her a lot of money. A lot of money. And now, lot of money. Although I really, in all fairness to Carl, I don't believe that it makes a bit of difference to him. I think he'd go with her no matter who left her that money. Sure, I can leave. This tape is dedicated to Mary, you know. She's the one that won the tape. So, Mary, here we go. First time I ever got thrown in jail was here in Portland. I always like coming back to Portland. This is the scene of the crime for me. Carl bailed me out of jail on Christmas morning, 1959. I'd been arrested for drunk in auto, I guess was technically the charge. They didn't catch me drunk driving. By the time the police arrived on the scene, the car was on its top. I was on my way from Portland to Eugene on Christmas Eve to see her. She wasn't expecting me. So she didn't notice when I didn't show up. In fact, with every reason to believe it, and I figured it out later, that her husband was probably home on Christmas Eve. So I may have gotten off easy just spending the night in jail. I don't know. I never, ever, ever wanted to have to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new here or starting your experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, I am surprised to be discovering on a daily basis that this program works for me. And I don't know how long the program works. We have 34 years, I think, is that the number, 34 years, and happy birthday to you and to the birthday people. And for me, it has worked for 19 years. And there are, and which is astonishing, because I'm just a drunk. I am just a drunk. There isn't any way that I can work in and of myself, and left to my own devices, I cannot work out any way to live in the world without going to jail all the time, because that's what I was doing when I met you. That's how it was. I started going to jail right here in Portland. I started a lot of things right here in Portland. I was laughing the other day thinking about coming out of a blackout on Burnside in a cafe, an all-night cafe, and I believe it was like about 2:30 in the morning or 3 o'clock in the morning. And I was sitting across the table from some delicate flower that I had invited to dinner that night. And I just suddenly sitting there, and you know, I have the bright lights in the cafe, and there's nothing romantic about it, and I'm sitting there at a table, and I'm right across the table from a gal that had chili all over her face and her blouse. Somehow she'd caught my eye in a nearby saloon. Rosie, as I recall. And I, coming out of the ether, took one look at her and realized that I had better get out of there, and lurched up to the cash register and paid whatever they told me. I had a few bucks left in my pocket, and stopped in the men's room on the way out, and the elegance of it included a sliver of a mirror still left on the wall. And I happened to glance in there, and I had chili all over my eyes. Maybe, I hope Rosie's in an AA meeting tonight telling the same story about that hideous apparition that appeared in her life. You know, you hear these guys saying, and then I woke up with something I couldn't believe. We always forget that we must have been a prize to look at in the morning like that. I'm glad I don't live like that anymore. I really am glad that I have the choice today of living in dignity. I don't always choose dignity, but it's available to me if I want it. I began to know that something was different about me long before I ever took a drink. I began to know that I was in some kind of never, never land, or always, always land, or whatever it was, sometime in my, after I started grade school, the differences were obvious to me. And I heard it expressed in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous years later. Somebody said that he always had the feeling that other people got secret instruction on how to get along in this world that he never got. And I had that feeling. I knew. I just knew that, and if it was a class of 30 people, that the other 29 of them knew things that I didn't know. And so I came along without any real sense of, and having an identical twin brother didn't really make much difference. If that's the way you're born, it doesn't, there isn't any way to compare it. So the fact that I was a twin didn't make me feel less isolated in any sense that I'm aware of. It seems to be a common experience among alcoholics, and we all come in here with a certain sense of isolation. And so if you're new here tonight, and if you are afraid and alone and wonder and have that secret feeling that everybody but you will leave this meeting and go to a big apartment someplace where they'll drink coffee and laugh all night, that's how I felt about it. I thought they almost live in a hotel, and everybody seemed to be knowing one another and having a lot of fun, and I was not a part of that. If you're new here tonight and are certain, as I was, that they're going to throw you out of here when they find out how bad you really are, welcome. Welcome. That will not happen to you. You will instead be allowed, if you choose, to stay here and go to meetings and learn that we're all alike. That we're all alike. If you're new here tonight and know beyond any shadow of a doubt that you cannot stay here because you're a drunk and that your drinking is just a little bit more intense, or that your drugs or your pills or whatever you do is just a little bit more important to you than it is to us, be of good cheer. This is a room full of people that had those thoughts. Because we all do what has been described as comparing our insides with the outsides of everybody around us, and we always come up short. Because everybody else looks together and happy and comfortable and without fear and free of the anxiety that we know that we have inside of us. So I welcome you if you're new here tonight. And I hope you go to lots of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope that you find your way into the many, many splendid meetings of AA that are here in the Portland area. A bail bondsman brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. He just one day said, "Where have you been?" I worked for him. I sold encyclopedias for this guy. We met because he bailed me out of jail. And he later gave me a job and continued to bail me out of jail. And one day I showed up in his office and he said, "Where have you been?" And I said, "I've been drunk." He said, "For a week? I haven't seen you in a week." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "I got to take you someplace." This was in 1966 in July. And I knew he was going to take me to Camarillo, which was the local nut house, or to the General Hospital where they'd give me a big bag of pills, or to back to jail. Never occurred to me that he might take me someplace as far-fetched as Alcoholics Anonymous. It didn't occur to me. I'd been to a meeting of AA right here in Portland in 1961 and walked away from that meeting knowing there wasn't any hope for me there, that whatever it was that was wrong with me, and God knows something was, it was not the same as what was wrong with you. I never intended to go back, because I knew that if my life is a shambles because I drink, that's the price you pay. But it's better than not drinking. It's better than going through life without any alcohol at all. And I knew that because the people that were in my life when I was a little kid didn't drink. And they were miserable. I remember those people in the Church of the Air in Billings, Montana, being uptight. We went to church 4 and 5 times a week, and they told us to give our hearts to Jesus. And those people that had given their hearts to Jesus didn't seem to be real thrilled about it. You know, I had an uncle that got carried away and went down to the front to get saved one Sunday morning, and it seemed like within a few months they were sending him to China to be a missionary. I lost interest. They tried. My mother had her questions that were so unanswerable. "Have you found God yet?" "Have you found God yet?" "No, I haven't found God yet." "What will you do when you meet your Maker?" "Who knows?" My dad used to say, when are you going to be a man? Well, I don't know, what time is it now? We got taken out to the Yellowstone River for a baptism one brisk March. Early March, just outside of Billings, Montana. We believe in complete immersion. I didn't find God. I didn't find very much of anything for about 3 days. There's always a mix. You know, the thing I love about Alcoholics Anonymous is that it is consistent and very, very simple. Very simple. You postpone one drink one day. I just got to postpone the next drink until tomorrow. That's all. It's very simple. I don't say that it's easy, but it's simple. And the 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous are not complex. They're not easy, but they are simple. And the questions that I was asked as a kid were confusing. And the double messages that you get about God being love, God is love. God loves you. Always followed by, you're going to burn forever, of course, but God loves you. And I just love the way they talked about sex, or didn't talk about sex. Great stuff. Sex, as you know, is dirty and disgusting, filthy, and you should save it for the one you really love. Like to say that doesn't create alcoholism, but it gives you something to work through after you get sobered up. That's why we sit around so late in those coffee shops at night. We don't know what else to do. It seemed to me that there just wasn't any hope, because I was not comfortable any place. It was not safe in church. It was not safe at home. It was not safe in school. In fact, school was safer than any of the other places. I never really was in a place where I felt safe until I came here. I don't know why. I just never felt safe. We had a home with violence in it. There was a lot of colorful nonsense that generated mainly by my dad when he drank. But my mother and my grandmother and my stepmother did their share of a more subtle kind of violence, and a more subtle kind of withholding, and a more subtle kind of anger. They were angry women. Angry women. And my dad was angry. And we grew up with that. And it's just part of it. Part of it. When I got out of high school, I had one secret. I did not come out of high school empty-handed, because I had had my first drink by then, and I had a secret. And the secret is, whenever it gets rough, you have a drink. There was always a message blinking, a light on and off in the back of my mind, under any circumstance and any time, after I had my first drink. And the message, the blinker that goes on and off like a sensor in an automobile that says your door is a jar, or your window is a door, or your, I don't quite know how it goes, but that message back there, that little blinker, says a drink will help. A drink will help. Always there. Always there. And just once in a while you reach over and punch it to activate it in case it begins to slow down a little. A drink will help. A drink will help. Let's have a drink. And I would go out of my way by mile to get the money necessary to go to the bar and have a drink, to cash the check, to do whatever is necessary. My entire life was run by the fact that I know a drink will help. And I'll tell you something. A drink helps. If you're new here tonight and you think we're going to get all exercised about the fact that a drink helps, hey, it helps. Or we would, none of us ever drank enough to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the glorious thing about people like us. A drink helps. 90, 85, 90% of the population is not helped by a drink. They take a drink and nothing. Nothing. I mean, they go into a bar for two drinks and they go home. Because Myrtle's got dinner ready, right? We don't really want to be social drinkers, you know. If you're new here tonight, can you imagine? You really want to be a social drinker? You don't want to be a social drinker. You know the difference? You're sitting in a bar and it's 11 o'clock and things are going pretty good and everybody's got a lot of energy and a lot of false courage and a lot of nonsense, and somebody says, "Let's go to Phoenix tonight." And there's two responses. Now tell me, which group would you rather be with? Those that say, "You bet your ass we're going to Phoenix." Or do you want to be with a group that says, "Phoenix, it's 11 o'clock at night and I have to get up in the morning." God, I laughed at Cliff Roach the other night. He was talking about just the use of the word fun. Oh, he's funny with that. I mean, we have fun when we drink. You really want to be one of those that, yeah, we had fun. It was fun. That's my Al-Anon contribution to the evening. I know they missed that. I shouldn't chew ice up here. It picks it up. I'm sorry, honey. Where was I? Fun. Thank you. Yeah. So welcome if you're new here tonight. When I came to the realization that booze was an important ingredient in my life, I had no idea that it would extract the price that it did. But it does. And the price is, the series of bad breaks that you've had are related to alcohol, if you're an alcoholic. It's not any accident that we've all spent an occasional night in the park. Maybe not all of us, but in one way or another, we have spent some absolutely terrible nights. Whether we're crawling around on a living room floor someplace in a lovely home in Westmoreland, or whether we're actually sleeping in the South Park blocks, or whatever it is that's happening in our lives, we are at the effect of and at the mercy of the fact that we're alcoholics. I can't drink a little bit. It seems like I ought to be able to. I had it hooked up in my mind that it was really how much I drank. I was astonished to learn after I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that the first drink got the job done. But if you think about it, it's absolutely right. You drop that first ounce in there and it's somehow or other. In fact, one of the definitions of alcoholism is an alcoholic is somebody that cannot predict his behavior after having one drink. It may not always turn out badly, but we don't know. We just don't know. Normal drinkers don't have that problem. They can drink one or two or three. They might drink 20 and get drunk, but it seems to be a matter of choice with them. And with us, it is not. The choice is always before the first drink. Then we have a choice. Then we have a true choice. Once we introduce an ounce of alcohol into our system, we really are stripped of choice. And so we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and really, all the rich gifts that we get in Alcoholics Anonymous begin with the simple fact that we are given a choice when we get here. A choice. And the choice is extraordinarily simple. In the morning, do I intend to be drunk today, or do I intend to be sober today? Knowing that there is no middle ground. No middle ground. Those days are gone. There is no middle ground. We're either drunk or we're sober. And I didn't believe it. And I damn near died before I believed it. And I paid the price that we all pay. It's easy to talk in terms of putting the cash up on the bar that the booze cost us. We even know vaguely in some odd sense that we lost the job because of the booze, and that we paid that price, and the car, and the home, and the family. Even though we work it out where it's somehow their fault, that's the price, the family, the wife and the kids, the price we pay. And then the price gets even a little steeper after we've lost all the people and all the material things in our life. The price goes up. The ante is raised because now, in order for me to take a drink, I got to put my self-respect up there on the bar. I've got to put my sense of honor up there on the bar. I got to put my sense of decency up there until it's all gone. Trade it. Day after day after day after day in my life, trade the most important and essential ingredient of inside where I really live. Trade them for a drink. Do I want to? Hell no. Am I sorry the price is so high? Yes. Will I stop drinking because of it? Absolutely not. That's all I have left. A few moments of chemical peace of mind in a day is better than no peace of mind at all. And so I put it all up there. And for me, that meant that after graduating from what was then called Portland State College, and after spending a couple of years at the dental school up on the hill and getting thrown out of there, and after going into the Marine Corps because the sign downtown outside the post office said the Marine Corps builds men, and after damn near getting thrown out of the Marine Corps, I moved to Glendale, California, lived in an apartment for a little while, and then moved into a car, and then the cars have a way of going away. I was, as I remember it, saving up for an oil change, and my timing is off. The car seized one day, just kind of, and fortunately it was near the curb. I never saw it again. So I lost that home. But there was a garage, and so I moved into the garage. And I was, when that bail bondsman brought me to AA, living in a garage with three other guys. A double garage. Plenty of room. And those days were characterized by a lot of colorful stuff, but all of it sad in a very special way. I had, as we do, begun to wake up in jail fairly regularly. You know, it's funny with all of that. I didn't really believe that I could be an alcoholic. Alcoholic's the guy in the next cell. Guy at the end of the bar. Whoever he is. Alcoholic's some guy that's on skid row with no place to live, and there I had a garage. Alcoholic, some guy doesn't have a job. And here I am in the height of a career selling encyclopedias. Alcoholic is some guy that wouldn't even dream of owning a car. And I dreamed of owning a car. And My sponsor's a funny guy. I don't know why this came to my mind, but he said that I heard that he got a car. I said, I understand you got another car. He said, yeah, I did. It's a car I've dreamed of owning for, God, I guess more than 10 years. I said, what is it? He said, a 1973 Ford. I don't know why I threw that in. There's no extra charge for that. It just doesn't seem to work right there, does it? Waking up in jail is interesting. Because when you know where you are, there's something about waking up in the garage you need to drink real bad. When I wake up in jail, I don't know why, but I don't need to drink quite as bad when I know where I am. You know, it's interesting. Waking up in jail is settling in another sense. It lends a certain predictability to your day. Won't get arrested here. And after they bring in that little plate of beans and the felony tank empties and the arraignments are over, you go down and stand in line for the misdemeanor count. And the judge, one by one, as they come up, asks, how do you plead? You know, when the burning issue of the day is whether you're going to plead guilty or not guilty, that is not really a good day. Or guilty with an explanation. And I was in there regularly, stood in front of Judge Ken White down there in the Glendale Municipal Court. And he got to know me on a, I don't know if we were on a first name basis, but he seemed to know who I was. He handled my rap sheet a little carelessly, I thought. Didn't give it the deference that it deserved. Guilty or not guilty, and it was never clear to me. I mean, if it's drunk, well, I wasn't really drunk. Not what you'd call drunk. Bad check? No, you have to form the intent. Who knew this one might go through? You never... It could happen. I got arrested one morning for drunk driving at 10 a.m. How do you plead? Guilty or not guilty? God, that was weird. I was at a stop sign, stop light. The light was red and I stopped. And it turned green. And amber, and red, and green, amber. I was resting. Guy behind me was in a squad car. Is he allowed up during these meetings? Your mother could see you now. That guy arrested me that morning for drunk driving. Couldn't believe he did that. I mean, I was doing really well. I was in a lawyer's office 3 weeks later reading the police report, and it said that the field sobriety test was discontinued because the suspect was injuring himself. But you know, in those days, you grasp for anything. And what's your badge number? You know, I'm into badge numbers in those days. I'm into jury trial. I want a jury of my trial. I'll tell you what I want. I want justice. If you're new here, don't you want justice? No, you don't. We've had about all the justice we want, I think. Mercy. Go for mercy. And it's, and we get it here. In AA, I have been consistently dealt with and treated at the level of my need and never at the level of my merit. You have consistently touched me right where I live. Ever since I first came here, ever since that bail bondsman brought me to you, you have touched me again and again and again and again. I've spoken to many people who lived like I did, and I have sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and listened to other members of AA share about how their lives went. And I have been touched on more occasions than I can possibly report to you. I remember with clarity the night I had a little room. There was one thing I had in that little room was a radio. And that radio would play at the oddest times. And if it was about 3 days away from a drunk, I couldn't get that radio to turn off. I'd pull a plug out of the wall and the radio would still play. And I remember hearing a guy from Riverside, California one night talk about his radio. And he said he took it out to the laundry tubs to drown the damn thing. And I knew in that instant that my radio wasn't playing either, that I was hallucinating. I don't know how you know it, but you just know it. And one more bit of information comes in that says, yeah, I'm just like these people. I remember with great clarity listening to a woman talk. Her name was Gail. She died sober last year, but she was about my age. And she was around in the Hollywood area when I was getting sober in 1966. In 1967, and I liked Gail very much because she looked sophisticated and she did not look stupid, and she looked like there was something else about her. She looked skeptical, and I liked to see her in meetings because I figured if she was going for this business, there might be something to it. I didn't think she'd buy in if it wasn't real. She just had that look about her. And I remember listening raptly one night. She was at the podium talking at a meeting on Wilshire Boulevard on a Sunday night. I can remember it very clearly. And she spoke from the podium about living in an apartment in Hollywood and coming out of a blackout, sitting on the mantel over the fireplace. And she's up there with her cat. And there's some vodka up there and some cat food up there. A little something for everybody, you know. And the reason that they're up there is because there's about 8 inches of water on the floor in the living room. And that was because she'd started to take a bath last Tuesday and the whole deal had gotten away from her somehow. And she's up there watching furniture float by. And she said, up there, coming out of that blackout, she uttered the alcoholic's prayer. I didn't know what that meant. And she told me. She said, it goes like this. Jesus, God, what's wrong with me? And I said that prayer many times, never thinking of it as a prayer. And she touched me when she said that because I knew she knew the despair and the fear, and the sense that you're losing your mind, and the notion that you'll never get out of it, that someday, someplace against a freeway abutment, or in a mental hospital, or in a psychiatric ward, or in jail, you're going to lose it all. I knew what people meant when they said if they'd have committed suicide while they were drinking, they would have killed the wrong guy. That person had so little to do with what's going on now. I remember when I was 9 months sober, having an experience that I've never forgotten. They let me on Monday night in Glendale come to the meeting early and set up the chairs. And I recommend you do that if you're new here.
get involved. And you know what it made me feel? It made me feel like I had a right to take up a chair in the meeting at 8 o'clock. If I had those, I had the straightest rows of chairs in town. I'd make the coffee. I set out all the cream and the sugar and all that stuff. Oh, I loved it. It made me feel terrific that they would let me set up the chairs in the meeting. By this time, I was out of the encyclopedia game and selling imprinted ballpoint pens. Not exactly an inspiring career, but the safe place in town for me was not my home. And it was certainly not out there on the street asking the guy at Joe's Union Station to buy 100 pens from me. The safe place for me was the AA Club in Glendale. And I would go up there right after work. And on Monday night, they let me set up the meeting. And I did it zealously and with a real sense of belonging, and I liked it a lot. And one night, just about the time, one Monday night, I got all those chairs set up, in came a group of five people. And they were part of the H&I committee. And they were on their way down to put on a meeting at a mental hospital in Norwalk, about 25 minutes away. And for God's sake, they asked me if I wanted to go with them. I was thrilled. I went over to the secretary of the meeting and asked permission to leave. You know, check with authority. You can't get any higher authority than the secretary of the meeting. And he said, sure, kid, go on. And by God, we all piled down those stairs and into the parking lot and got in Bill Christian's old Chrysler. I sat in the middle in the back seat. And we drove down the freeway. And I loved being around those people. I'd seen them. I'd watched them. They were the ones that were having fun. They were the ones that seemed to be, they had the look, what I heard later described as the Molokai look. You know, the people that went over there to work with the lepers often contracted the disease, and it's a disfiguring disease. And so after a while, they were not real pretty, but they had that Molokai look in their eyes. It's the look of people that are consistently willing to give more than they get out of life. And these people had that. You see it around AA a lot. The look of people that are consistently willing to put more in than they get out. And they seem to be going first class. They seem to be the ones that are laughing. They seem to be the ones that are really having fun, that are having a rich life. And I loved being included in that group of people. There they were, five of them, some with 7, 8, 10 years, 12 years of sobriety, and they were out there putting their money where their mouth is, and they were going down to the mental hospital on a Monday night to put on a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was included in that group. And I was thrilled to death, and I sat quietly and listened to them chatter and laugh, and once in a while a remark would be directed to me, and I would nod or burp or do something cute, and on we'd go. And 25 minutes later, we pulled off the freeway and into the hospital grounds and parked, and they pointed out the building to me where we were going to go and put on a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous for the patients in the mental hospital. And I got out of the car with them, and it hit me. It just suddenly I knew. I don't know why it had not occurred to me earlier. I did, and it made my knees buckle. I almost got sick. I just had that sickening feeling that came with the realization of why they'd included me. Six of us were going in that nut house. Five of them were coming back out of that nut house. And my next thought was, I can outrun every one of these old bastards. And the next thought I had was, if they think I belong in there, maybe I do. Maybe I do. I'd been around AA for 9 months. Hadn't had a drink in 9 months. I'd sat in meetings virtually every night for 9 months. And set up chairs on Monday night for a couple of months. I don't think I knew I was alcoholic. I knew I was powerless over alcohol. God, my powerlessness has been demonstrated to me time and again. Powerlessness is no big dramatic thing, you know. If you're new here, powerlessness is sort of like We can't predict our behavior once we started to drink. But powerlessness is simply being unable to get out of the garage. Powerlessness is put your hands behind your back. Powerlessness, get in a car. I'll tell you what powerless is. Powerless is when they take your hand and say, here, just relax, we'll roll your finger over like that. Can't even go through a fingerprinting process without help. Powerless. Little demeaning things that become the fabric of my life. Powerless over alcohol. It's an interesting thing because we all come in here with a different definition of what it is to be an alcoholic. Don't worry about that. Ask yourself if you're powerless over alcohol. You may not know what an alcoholic is, and you may be able to quibble about its definition, but you know what alcohol is, and I guarantee you, you know what powerless is. If those two are hooked up in your life, welcome. Welcome. And I guarantee you, you know what powerless is. If those two are hooked up in your life, welcome. Welcome. And so I'm out of the car, and we're at the Norwalk State Mental Hospital, and we're walking, Metropolitan State Mental Hospital in Norwalk, and we're walking across that asphalt parking lot, and I'm not real happy. Because I know what's going to happen when we go in there, and I've also somehow or other, by some grace, learned to trust you by this time. Although I didn't even know it. I just kept walking. We went inside the building. We went in the day room. We sat down. The orderly brought in the patients and they sat there. And we put on a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I read chapter 5. I said nothing after that. I looked the patients over. Wondered how I'd look in paper slippers in those robes. And an hour went by and we stood up and held hands and said the Lord's Prayer. And the orderly came back and took the patients back upstairs. And we all walked out onto the parking lot and across and into Bill Christian's old Chrysler. And drove back to Glendale. And I slept in my own bed that night. Astonished that I trusted you like that. Because I'd never really ever trusted anybody, and you were virtual strangers, and I'd only known you 9 months, and yet things were happening in my life that made me know you really only wished me well, and that you would not lie to me and had not lied to me, and that you welcomed me no matter what I happened to think of myself. And that and other instances like that made it possible for me to stay here. I wasn't anxious to jump into these steps. My sponsor used to tell a story about, after a while, I moved over to the west end of town and I did get a sponsor, but I was 2 years sober then. And I finally hooked up with one of these step Nazis that we have around Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God he has saved my life. Because you know what? I got to change. I'm just a drunk. The guy that I was when that bail bondsman took me to the meeting in 1966 was a drunk. And there's no way that guy cannot be a drunk. There's no way that guy can stay sober. And the only way is to change. And I have changed. These steps have changed me, and they will change you too. There's 12 of them. I didn't want to take them. It was explained to me that it was not necessary that I want to take them. Necessary that I take them, yeah, but I don't have to want to. I explained to him, I don't want to take these. He said, fine, no problem. It's okay. Take them without wanting to. Well, how do I do that? Well, didn't your brother sign a promissory note as a cosigner for you when you were in dental school? Yeah. Did you pay it back? No. There's something about paying the money back that gets their attention. Carl at that time didn't know much about Alcoholics Anonymous, but he knew that it involved getting his money back. When he got that money, in those days I used money orders, and I'd send him a money order every month for $34.10. I had a little, God, they hated to see me coming at the bank. Mr. Hodges, if you just get a checking account, we wouldn't have to charge you 35 cents for these money orders, and this week you want 19 of them. Money order only cost you, a check would only cost you 4 cents. And I'd say, I know. Or if I was feeling ornery, I'd say, you know, when I write a check, it usually costs me a $100 fine and about 3 days in jail. It's interesting. There's 12 steps. I didn't want to take them. If you're new here tonight, you won't want to take them. But you don't have to want to take it. It's what changes us. Those steps were created, were fabricated out of the combined experience of the early members of Alcoholics Anonymous as a way of framing the means by which they were able to bring about a change in themselves. As a way of allowing themselves to get in a position that God could do for them what they could not do for themselves. 12 steps. They didn't want to take them. If they'd have found a way to get sober on 7 steps, that's all the steps we'd have. We got 12. I thought half of them must be thrown in there just for drill somehow, you know, to lend symmetry to chapter 5 or something. My sponsor used to tell a story about a guy that lived in a fishing village in Alaska. And he had my kind of an attitude. What he did, at the end of the day, he didn't work, but he would go up to a fishing boat that had just come in with a catch, and he would say to the skipper, "Give me a piece of fish." And the skipper would throw him a piece of fish, and the guy would scuttle off someplace, cook up his fish, sleep under a bridge or a pier or whatever he did in the summertime. Elsewhere, I guess, in the winter, and that would be that. And he stayed alive that day. And one day, there's a new boat in the fleet, and he goes up, it's the new skipper's turn, and he goes up to the new skipper and said, "Give me a piece of fish." And the skipper said, "Who the hell are you?" And he said, "I'm Joe." He said, "What do you want a piece of fish for?" He said, "Well, I haven't had dinner yet, and it's your turn." And he said, "I can't do that." He said, "What do you mean? Everybody does." He said, "Well, I don't know exactly. I just can't do that." "You mean just give you a piece of fish?" And the guy said, "Yeah." He said, "I'll tell you what I can do. I can bring you aboard for a season and teach you how to fish so you'll never have to ask anybody again in your life for fish. But it's not in me to do so little for you as to throw you a piece of fish." And the guy was just like me, because he said, "I'll tell you what, just why don't you give me a piece of fish? I don't want to be a nuisance. I don't want to clutter up your boat for a season. Just give me a piece of fish and I'll get out of your way." The guy said, "Sorry, I can't do that." And I spent 2 years around Alcoholics Anonymous saying, "Give me a piece of fish. Don't tell me I have to write an inventory. Give me a piece of fish. Don't tell me I have to list my phone number and my right name. Give me a piece of fish. Don't tell me I have to pay child support. Give me a piece of fish. Don't tell me I have to be self-supporting through my own contributions." And I had the bad luck of running into this step Nazi, and he was not into fish. But you know what? He taught me how. He taught me how to fish. He taught me how to fish. I asked Gloria for a piece of gum the other day. She said, "I can't give you a piece of gum. I can teach you how to gum." No, she didn't. It It just gets away from me sometimes. I don't know. The needle slips over a couple of grooves. It's an exciting place to be, this Alcoholics Anonymous, because we get an opportunity to see extraordinary growth in other people. You know what? If you're new here tonight, it's not going to be very long before you're sitting in a meeting someplace and somebody is going to get up to take a chip and you're going to find out an astonishing thing. You are glad to see that person getting up to take a chip and there's nothing in it for you. Somebody will get up and take a year birthday cake that you've known for 7 months because that's how long you've been around here, and you will have tears in your eyes and you will think, Jesus, there's a certain humanity to me after all. I do have the capacity to care. I'm developing something other than those animal things that I had when I came in here. It's an exciting place to be because this is where we begin to grow and thrive. And I believe with everything in me that we can become whatever we want to become. I believe with everything in me that we have the most splendid opportunity that's ever been given to anybody here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe it because it's happening to me. I believe it because when I came in here and had my last drink on the 14th of August, 1966, I was whipped. I lived in a garage in Glendale, California, sold encyclopedias when I could get out of bed, and was more often in jail than I would like to tell you, and was out of any kind of credit and out of any kind of credibility and had no way to live. Had no sense of God in my life, had no sense of people in my life, had no purpose in my life, and had no self-worth. And none of those things is true today. For 19 years and a couple of months, I've been here with you. Day by day by day, I have had an opportunity to rejoin the human race, to become the kind of person that I always wanted to be. And the process is still going on. I've been in touch with some stuff recently about me that I would never have known, but for the splendid opportunity that I've been given here to live a sober life. And I've had to come face to face many times with some things about me that I don't like at all. The way I operate and what I do and what I reach for instinctively when I'm confronted or threatened. And I've had to come to terms with the fact that I'll never be perfect. I've had to come to terms with the fact that progress really is what this is all about. That I can be anything I choose to be, and the choice you have given me is really incredible. The choice on the first day I was here is, am I going to drink or not? I didn't have that choice before I came here. And the choice today is not only am I going to drink or not, but am I going to live my life to its fullest? Am I going to be the kind of person that I really enjoy being around? And the answer is, yeah, I'll choose that. I'll choose life. I'll choose a way to go that enriches my life and enriches the life of the people around me because I laugh more that way. If you're new here tonight, there is a secret in AA. There is a secret here, and you've known it since you've been in here. Secret is not very complex either. It's like the secret that was so well kept during the Second World War. That secret was not the details of how to make that bomb. The secret that nobody was talking about during the war was that it could be done at all. Because once it was out and once people knew it could be done, somebody was going to do it. And that's the secret here. You can't walk into an AA meeting without knowing that it can be done. We've been, you know, it's so wild to me. The greatest celebration in Christendom is the resurrection. More people celebrate that every year around the world than any other event. And it's formed a part of our heritage for 2,000 years. All it means is brought back to life. I've been resurrected. And so have you. It's no less a miracle because it happened to me. It's no less a miracle because it happened to you. And the miracles are just beginning. Thank you.